My name is Harry Klein. I'm a fourth-year seminary student at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. The program that we are going to be presenting today and tomorrow would be entitled Ministry Among People of Color. As we sit here in this room or within the village, we are the majority. We're white people, primarily of Lutheran faith. And yet, when it comes to the total world, we are really the minority. And I know for myself, it hasn't been until recently that I've really begun to give that some thought. And so, for the next 2 days now, we are going to be dealing with some of the other races of the world. With me today are Ray Hagberg and his very lovely family, and I wish Ray would introduce them to you at this time.
Wife Nellie Faye, son Vaughn, daughters Rochelle and Lene.
Ray and his family have served a ministry in Tanzania for the past 27 years. And so today is going to be your opportunity to ask questions of them and listen to their discussion of their ministry in that country. Tomorrow, we will be dealing with the Eskimo people of Alaska, where I spent a whole month. So I feel like I'm really inexperienced by far compared to Ray and his family. I would open it up to Ray by asking him to really tell us what missionary work is all about in terms of the call to missionary. Ray?
Thank you. Well, first of all, we recognize that the call to mission is God's call to serve all people in all parts of the world. And this is nothing new. It's simply proclaiming God's love and caring for people wherever they are. One of the lessons during the, I think it's the second, or what, the B series of lectionaries uses the Luke 4, and from there is quoted from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. And it reads like this: "The sovereign Lord has filled me with his spirit. He has chosen me and sent me to bring good news to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to announce release to captives and freedom to those in prison. He has sent me to proclaim that the time has come when the Lord will save his people." That's the message of love and of hope. And this is from the time in the Old Testament, and Isaiah wrote about this. And Christ, in turn, read that as part of his teaching, that what he was about in the world and what we should be about. First of all, to be filled with the Spirit. Unless we're filled with the Spirit, we can do a lot of good works, but I don't think it can be called proper mission work. I don't think that it would be proclaiming the good news. At best, it would be only a small part of the good news. And then it goes on to list, doesn't say just to preach and to teach, but to heal, to announce release to the captives. Captives of sin, those who are captive of sin, and freedom to those who are in prison, those who have been dealt unjustly in the world, in whatever way we can. And then to proclaim that the time has come when the Lord will save his people. The very center of hope, which is what all peoples long for any place in the world. Then we have many other traditional passages. We've all heard, and we hear often, Matthew 28, 19 to 20, go ye therefore into all the world. And in Acts, the first chapter 1, 7 and 8, where begin in the city of Jerusalem and you go in concentric circles around the city and unto all parts of the world. So this is the call that we have as Christians to proclaim the good news. And not only the call, but it's the task. It's the given task we have. And don't let us feel that it's, you know, for a few special people. It is for everyone. No one is able to squeeze out of it, really. Because we are sent to proclaim the good news to those who are nearest to us, wherever we live. And if we can't go ourselves, at least enable the word to be proclaimed, the good news to be lived out by people witnessing all over the world. So that's the basis that I would see for mission. It's not our task. We're simply tools in the hands of God, carrying out His command or His task. We happen to have served in Tanzania the whole time of our missionary career. When we first went out, I was a teacher, and we worked with the primary schools, mostly in administration, and very shortly was involved in evangelism. And over this period of time, we've been in and out of education and evangelism, or preaching and teaching in the churches as opposed to in the schools. The mission field, I suppose, offers one of the greatest varieties of work, and in at least in our instance, some of the greatest freedom that you could ever find any place. Sometimes it's too much and it's awesome, because you're free to choose, and sometimes you have to choose on your own what you're going to do. And yet it's been a great challenge, and it's been a wonderful experience. One of the highlights of the time that we've served, for my part in particular, and I am speaking for myself because I was directly involved, was teaching for 2 years in a junior seminary, which amounted to a high school, really, education. It was young men who had been working in congregations. They were brought together, and we taught them for 2 years, preparing them so they could enter into the seminary program. And we began with a class of 16. The second year we had 12, and out of that 12, 11 of them completed the seminary training, which is an unusual record. We wouldn't even dreamt of having that high a record. And from among those students today, there's the president of our synod, the Arusha Synod. There are several district presidents and a number of very good pastors. This has been one of the greatest joys and rewarding things of mission work. Maybe first of all, we should go back a little bit on where we've been. Most of you, I think, have an idea of where Tanzania is. The continent of Africa is a huge mass of land. The United States, if you take a map of the United States to of correct proportion, you could fit it on here three times and you still have corners left over. So Tanzania, although it looks like rather a small area down there, is still quite a good sized area. And it's just south of the equator, but it's quite a temperate climate in most of the place because it's on a high plateau. So we're not in the deep, dark jungles of Africa like so much of our schooling would teach the way the continent is. There are jungles and there are a lot of harsh places on the continent of Africa, but much of East and Central and South Africa is very, very good country. It's a productive country. In part, it varies a great deal, but it's for the most part rather temperate. And of course, the further south you get, the more so, even on the coast. At this close to the equator, of course, it's very hot, and it's uncomfortable living for quite a bit of the year. We are inland here. This is approximately where Arusha is, or Mount Kilimanjaro would be right in there, and we're then about 150 miles south of that. The church first sent missionaries to this part of the world, that is in the modern age, in the 1800s, the last part of the 1800s. It goes right along hand in hand with the colonial expansion. In some instances, the missionaries went ahead. In some instances, the colonial occupation took place first, and missionaries followed. Other times, the missionaries went in, and they in turn, I suppose you could say, invited or made way for the colonial governments to come in. Now, there's a lot of history in this, and we shan't try to get into that. In all fairness, though, I think we have to say that colonialism was not entirely a bad thing, because it did open up Africa. Colonialism did a lot of bad things, the same as any other system. Now, I'm reminded of our old bishop, Stefano Moshi. He was the first leader of our church in Tanzania. Upon a return from one of his visits to Ethiopia and also to Liberia, one of the most impressive things, one of the things that made most impression upon him was how undeveloped or underdeveloped these countries were in compared to Tanzania. And he'd been one of the leaders in the fight for independence, for freedom, as from colonialism. And he could recognize the benefits that they had, the infrastructures that were built. This doesn't justify colonialism, though. This is simply a matter of history. The church in Tanzania has been, or the Lutheran church in Tanzania has been a leader in self-rule. Just prior to political independence, the church became self-governing, and they've expanded and grown, and there's been very good cooperation. This did not mean the end of missionary work. As a matter of fact, in some instances, there was an increased amount of missionary work for a period, but world economics and as well as political tensions and developments to this point. Now, of course, the missionary personnel are very much decreased, and which should be if we've done our job. The church was responsible for beginning most of the educational institutions in the country up to the time of independence. The church, when I say church, that is all of the churches, the missions and all the churches, were responsible for the major part of the medical services that were provided up to that point. And in Tanzania, we were very, very fortunate that there'd always been quite a good relationship between the African institutions, that is, in the tribal groupings, and the church. This is due in part because Tanzania had never been a colony. It had been a trust territory, but it had never been a colony as such, like Kenya and Uganda and many of the West African and Central African nations. So the church has had a chance to grow maybe more freely. They've been free of many of the dissensions and the divisions that you find in so many of the other countries in Africa. Now, missionary work began first about 100 years ago. It was begun by German missionaries from a number of different mission societies. The First World War saw all of the German missionaries interned and expelled. They did return again in the 1920s. In the 1939 and 40, again they were expelled. And this is when, in Tanzania, that the American churches really had a chance or were invited to come in and did come in. And from the end of 1940s and especially in the 1950s, quite a number of personnel from the United States, the Lutheran churches in the United States, and then in the 60s and 70s, many of them from Europe have gone to help the church in Tanzania. The population of Tanzania now is approximately 20 million people, and very roughly speaking, about a third of them are Christian. About a third of them are Muslim or Islamic faith. A third then would still be classified as animists practicing their old religious beliefs that they knew from their tribal backgrounds. Maybe I want to stop talking.
Tanzania has at least 120 tribes. We have a common language. The official language of the country is called Swahili, which is a Bantu language. And English is then the second language. So in schools, beginning with second grade, children would start to learn a little English. A lot of the high school education is done in English. University training is done solely in English. Children start to school in Tanzania at approximately 8 or 9 years of age. There are no school buses, the children walk. And this is the main reason why they don't start school till they're older. Some of them walk 3-4 miles to school and that far again home. So they need to be at least 8 years old to go to school. They attend school for 7 years, then they take an examination. If they do well on the examination, they have hopes of attending high school or a trade school, nurses training, or something of that nature. Tanzania is aiming for 100% compulsory education. I think they feel they have attained 98% now of the children. They have one of the highest records in Africa on adult literacy as well. Of all of these children, of say 98% of the children in Tanzania, and there are a lot of them, 2% or less get to go on to high school or any further training after they complete their 7 years of elementary education. This creates a lot of frustrated young people and frustrated parents at seeing dead end of what is going of the education of their children. Last fall, from October into December, I had 12 English students of all young people. The class was started for pre-nursing students whose English was not up to par to go into nurses training. 8 of these students were students who had just finished 7th grade, taken their examination, waiting for results. So I said, well, hey, come and join the class. You can improve your English until you find out what's happening, but it's for self-improvement. So they did. Out of those 8, only 2 got to go on to high school. 6 were very capable of doing the work. 2 could have made it, but would have had to work really hard. But 6 were very capable. 3 were very bright students, a delight for any teacher. You explain something once and they learned it. My heart bled for these kids that couldn't go on. One girl in particular, who I would say was the second best in the class, she was Muslim. She wanted to go to high school or she wanted to go into nurses training. And as some of you may know, or all of you may know, the Muslim faith does not hold their women in high esteem. They are second-class citizens. This girl's father refused to let her go on to anything that wasn't necessary, even though she was the best in her class from grade school. The students I had came from two different grade schools. And I could sense her deep frustration at everything being limited. She would probably be married off to some older man. And I really felt for her, but she's just one of many, many, and many. As it was pointed out yesterday in our Bible study, that Jesus held women in higher esteem than the norm of the day. And this is what the church has done throughout the world as they have gone into many places, is trying to raise the level of women. There has been a lot of progress made in Tanzania with marriage licenses, that marriages are not official and recognized unless they are recorded with the government, and in turn, by getting a marriage certificate, the wife then has some rights as far as inheritance and her children and those things. Traditionally, the children belong to the husband. If the husband and wife separate, the children remain with the father. The wife has no claim to her children after the first year of life in many instances. There are women now in many parts of government, and so they are taking a leading role in development of the country. But still, women are pretty much the backbone of the labor force. Over 80% of all your food production is done by women. They carry the real burden of all the farm work. A typical example is the husband goes off to a salary job someplace. The wife stays home on the farm, which averages 2 to 3 acres. All the work is done by hand, raises the children, raises all the food. He might send money home to help her. He might come home twice a year. He might be the kind that's coming home every night or once a week or whatever. But pretty much, she is supporting the family, clothing those children to go to school, buying their school supplies, the medicine that they might need, and whatever. It is estimated, and I think this is probably very true, that for women between the ages of 16, 18, up to 40, 20 years of their life, they are either pregnant or nursing a child or both. And yet they are 80 to 90% of the labor force of raising food for the country. So you can see what this does. The mother is also the last one to eat. The father eats first. The children eat, and mother eats last, if there's anything left. But yet she is the main labor force. The quality of education in Tanzania, I would say, is deteriorated a lot in the last 5 to 10 years. With the population explosion which has occurred, when we went to Tanzania in 58, the population was approximately 9 million. The last census report I saw just before we left, it was 21.7. So you can see it's really going by leaps and bounds. A few years ago it was said, when it was about 18 million, that over 50% of the population, no, I think it was 65, was under the age of 15. When these get to marriageable age and start producing children, you can see why we've had this tremendous population explosion. And of course, antibiotics and drugs have helped keep people alive. They have not been able to keep up in trying to get every child into school, been able to keep up with classrooms, teachers, supplies, and so forth. So they lowered the standard for teachers. A teacher can finish 7th grade, have informal training, just like we did way back when my mother became a school teacher, and my older sister. Then they might go off for a year's training, come back, and are teachers in the classroom, where before the standards were much higher. Therefore, when you get a teacher who is a product of this first situation, the level of the education of the teacher is slipping. And therefore, how can you teach more when you haven't had it yourself? A teacher is lucky if she has a textbook. The children do not have textbooks. The teacher writes everything on the blackboard. The children copy it in their little notebooks. A lot of education is done by rote learning. Do you have any questions to this point that you'd like to ask on the subjects that we've covered so far? Yes?
What kind of exam do they take that cuts them down so to 2%? And who grades those papers?
Oh, it's education officers. It's education officers.
It's a set examination for the whole nation.
The
say, yeah, it's the educational system. First of all, was the British system, where you had a number of examinations and points, then where you divide, which is still true of much of Europe. Now it's only after the seventh year they've done away with the one after the fourth year. Then they used to have one after the eighth year. They used to have one then after the tenth year, and then after the 12th year. But now there's only the one after the seventh year. And then after 4 years of the seventh, and then after the 11th year again.
How were you transported there?
You mean what?
Your actual setting.
What we use for transportation. We have a four-wheel drive Toyota pickup, and then my husband uses a motorcycle a lot. Gasoline is a problem. We often have to haul it from Arusha. It's $4.50 a gallon. $4.50 a gallon. That's right, you heard correctly. And so I remember one Christmas day, or was it second day Christmas? We celebrate the second day Christmas as well from German tradition. He went off in the morning and he said if the one shopkeeper in Babati hadn't gotten any fuel for him, he didn't know if he'd have enough to get home. He might end up walking home. We had used all we had. In fact, the day he took me to leave after I'd heard my mother had a stroke, we drained every container we had at home to get us to the border.
Are there any waterways for the natives to use?
There are lakes. We have a lake near us.
They canoe from place to place?
No. There is no continuous water
system. Walk.
Most of them walk. There are buses. Buses are crowded, irregular schedules, and now expensive. So people do a lot of walking. We have a neighbor in our village. It's over 100 years old, and he walks. And one day he tried to walk to Babati, which is the nearest big town to us, which is 10 miles away. And he just about made it.
Well, he made it.
He made it, but was the poor man tired. But they walk everywhere they go.
Bicycles are also another means of transportation that if people can afford them, they will buy a bicycle to get around.
What has happened to the industrialization, if it was any, during the British colonization, and what's happened to it since?
Well, the same thing that has happened over in much of the developing world. Tanzania put a major part of their emphasis of development upon industrialization and neglected agriculture. And the whole world is suffering for it. And these countries in particular, of course. Industrialization didn't, in many times it wasn't managed properly. They can't get raw materials. The world economy now is such that they can't afford the raw materials. So you have the factories in Tanzania on the average are running about 30-50% capacity at best. It's been kind of a disastrous time. Not for Tanzania only, for much of the developing world.
Yeah, that's my understanding of most of the African countries, that their industrialization has gone downhill in proportion to the degree that they've gotten away from colonization development.
Well, or to say in proportion to their capacity, because they didn't. There's been a great deal of industrial building. That is, factories. Many factories have been built. Tanzania, as an example, had almost no milling industry. Weaving industry. Now textiles, and they have factories all over, but they're operating at such low capacity that it's just very unprofitable. They have the cotton, they don't have the dyes, or they don't have the spares, and things like that. It's frustrating. It is just unbelievably frustrating.
And are they? Do they need food? I mean, are they hungry, those people?
Well, Tanzania, yeah. in a good year, a good agricultural year, where we get adequate rain and so forth, can feed itself. But if it's not a good year, like we've had 3 years in a row, this last year now since I left, the end, 1st of March, my husband came at the end of April, they had more rain and the prospects mm-hmm. looked better. But otherwise, for 3 years in a row, we just didn't have enough.
What's the principal crop?
Maize.
Corn.
And then everything grows. It's someplace, different climates, different altitudes. Peanuts and rice and bananas and millets, corn,
beans,
forestry, lots of beans.
Do they export anything?
Coffee.
Coffee.
Gems. Sisal is available, but there's little world market for it.
It's picking up right now.
Going back to more natural products, Sisal has regained some of its market, but Tanzania was the biggest exporter of sisal in the world before synthetics came in. Sisal is used for making rope.
Rope, binder twine,
any of those of you who are from farming background of making bales and that.
How do you folks get your food?
We try and grow, have a lot of our own, because the nearest place to go shopping is 115 miles away. And even there, little is available.
We have a supermarket.
No, there's no supermarket in Tanzania. There is in Kenya. Most things we buy this here and that there. I mean, meat I get locally when I can. We raise rabbits for our main source of meat. We are a few miles from a lake. If I can hire someone to go down to the lake to get fish when the boat comes in, we can get some fish. We have our own chickens for eggs. An egg, by the way, is about, if you buy it in Arusha, a regular grade A, AA size egg is about 45 cents each. And then I can buy beef and pork. But no regular set schedule of when they're butchered is available. Sometimes I hear it is, sometimes I don't. You just get a hunk or whatever and then you fix it. You don't go and buy a steak or a roast or hamburger. You do it yourself.
Do you have refrigeration?
Yes, we have a kerosene refrigerator with a small freezing compartment on top. I use propane gas for cooking. A lot of charcoal. I use charcoal a lot because the propane gas is hard to get and it's very expensive.
Ray, would you tell us a bit about your local congregation, people of your church?
We're in an area that's relatively new. It was just in the last part of the 40s or 50s when this area, this valley where we live now, was being populated by outsiders. But as the local tribe, there were very few Christians, and there hadn't been missionary work done among them until the last part of the 40s. After the war, then, is the same thing that happened in all the rest of the world. When the soldiers came back, they'd been out and they'd seen the world, and things were really beginning to change, and they moved around a lot. At the same time, the population began to increase, so they began moving in to places like this valley where we live, because it was good soil and there was communication. There was a road that went through there. So it was in the early 50s when people began to trickle down from other areas, and a few Christians, they would gather together and they would want to have a congregation. And so they would one of their people would lead them, and after they got a few of these small groups, then they asked the church from, happened to be in Bulu at that time, to give them pastoral care. This changed then, and instead of from this side, then they oriented themselves to Arusha because of the transportation mainly. And the first pastor to go down there to serve was a true missionary, African. But he left his home country, and it would have been about a 3-day trip for him to get to this area. And he served that church until he was killed in a truck accident. Then it continued to grow. In the 60s, new congregations just kept popping up all over the place until in 1972, it was still one congregation, but they had 32 preaching points and one pastor.
Who was the son of the original one who was killed in the accident?
And but there was an evangelist in every one of these places, or at least in almost every one. And then he had a couple of assistants. They were, I suppose you call them licensed evangelists or whatever. They were not ordained pastors, but they helped him, and they would give communion and baptize and go around and help. Then, 1973, the whole structure of the church was reorganized because it was a new synod formed in this area. And this one congregation then was divided up into six congregations. And the congregation that we work with right now, they at that time had five preaching points. When I came then to began working there in 82, they had 11 preaching points. So you can see the church is expanding. It's not because of missionaries, and it's not because of you know, the pastors. We're all a part of it, but the major part of the work is carried on by dedicated and committed Christians who love their church, and if they, wherever they go, they take their church with them. And this is the way that the church has spread. This is the reason the church has grown in Africa, all over Africa. In the very beginning, say at the turn of the century, in the first few decades after the century, it was teachers and some businessmen, teachers especially, because they would be sent all over. And remember, they were always trained, almost always trained in a church school. And they would go out, and they were teachers and pastors and leaders in the community, and their stature in the community was very, very high. They were almost always one of the top leaders in communities, the best educated. Well, this has changed a lot. Now teachers are not held in very high esteem, and many people have much better education than teachers, but they still have the same awesome burden of teaching. So you can get an idea of the vitality of the church in this respect. Then another point, or another way of seeing the vitality of a church, when they are working together. In 82, this congregation where we are now, they had a total income or a budget of about 14,000 shillings. This is between 400 and 500 people. In 1983, they had a budget of or an income of 29,000. In 1984, it was 51,000. And this year, I know they'll hit 70,000. And this, they're giving, you know, in spite of the hardships that they have to suffer. But there's no place in the world that you can see generosity more openly and more freely given, I don't think, than in Africa. I know it happens all over the world in many places, but there it's, they're still close enough to their old I suppose, tribal traditions and the way that they lived and helping one another. There's a negative side to it, of course, as well, but the church can be very, very vital, and they can put us to shame in many ways in stewardship of time first. Because it's not hard to get, usually, where there's an active congregation, to get people to come out and work. We've built eight churches in the last year and a half. Not a contractor among them. It's all on their own. The local people do it. Some of the buildings are very simple, but there's still a lot of work. And others are not so simple, with burnt brick and a big roof structure nearly as big as this building, not this building, but this room here, and the full width of the building. So it's exciting, and it's great. And the other thing that's, I think, at least has got me excited right now is what can be done with the youth. Probably sometimes because of disillusionment with some of the problems we have with social problems, I guess, that are creeping in. But the youth, last year in August, well, every year, they have what we call a camp. It's just a camp, and the youth are invited to come together. The majority of the youth come from our church, but they also invite a youth from the neighboring churches, as well as non-Christians together. And we had 262 young people for a weekend. No kitchens, and no dormitories, no beds.
They brought their mats and slept on the ground.
Well, many of them didn't even bring mats. They just have a blanket, lay down. When it came time to sleep, lay down and sleep. But I mean, that wasn't bad. A few of them were invited to homes. Others chose not to. They'd rather just stay in around. Well, we were in a school where there were classrooms, and used that. But most of the meetings were outside, and the vitality is just the same thing, you know, as a bunch of young people from any place in the world.
Oh, well, I was the youngest, and when I started school, we were living 25 miles from Arusha. There wasn't a place for me to go to school, and also then the first grade was a lot farther. And so my mom taught me my first 2 years of school, and then for the second grade I went to boarding school. And then I was at boarding school except for fourth grade till I finished 10th grade, and then my parents came back to the States for 2 years. And so I had finished my last 2 years of high school here in the States. The education, you know, what I had in Africa was very comparable. You didn't have some of the classes, all the classes, maybe didn't have all the business classes, or maybe some of the book. But I think we moved to a farming community, so there weren't any of
the
yeah, there weren't a lot of the extras. We had the sports, there was band, you know, music, but we didn't have, you know, things like welding, auto repair, things like that you can get in high schools in the States. I think for me the bigger shock was not coming to a school in the States, but more the change in culture, going from an institution in boarding school where a lot of your activities are governed. You know, you had to stay in your dorm, you know, after a certain time. To come into the States where there's nothing governing you, and just trying to readjust to that, you know, like Saturday night going to movies, or, you know, going and doing things, or just even weeknights. And even through college, that has been a struggle for me. But yet I think I've also been blessed by that, because I haven't had near the exposure to alcohol problems, drug problems, it's there at the mission boarding schools, but it's not as widespread. If you want to get involved in that, you can. You know, even in a mission boarding school, a very strict mission boarding school. But yet I'm thankful that I wasn't exposed to that through all my years of, you know, high school. And just being within a Christian community makes a lot of difference, too. And I think I could say for each one of us, someday we would like to go back to Africa. Maybe not to Tanzania, but just being part of another country, being exposed to another culture, there's that desire to go back, as a missionary again.
It's always hard to come back here than to go back there.
That's home to you.
Yeah, I'm home. But even as far as culture shock goes, I think more people have a greater culture shock coming back here than ever going over there. Mm-hmm. And when you come back here and you see all the stuff, and you walk into a grocery store, and I mean, there's not even just one brand of something, but there's 10. What do you buy?
It was interesting when we would be preparing to go on leave. They would always say, we're going to the States. Ray and I would say, we're going home. But they would always say, they were going to the States. And the one thing that I saw in comparison with many other children here was because of our moving around, home was where Mom and Dad were. They weren't that attached to a house or a place where some of my relatives and other people remarked about. And as long as Mom and Dad were there, they would go to bed anywhere. Yet that wasn't as important as kids raised here. And I think because of the closeness of our missionary family, which is very unique, and we've been told that in Tanzania more so than many other places, our children have an ease of talking with adults, because when we have our get-togethers, it was everybody together. The kids weren't sent off to watch television because there wasn't any, for one thing, but it was always family-orientated and group-orientated. And I feel, in watching them grow up and in their teen years and in their college years, they had a much greater ease of conversing with adults than kids that I would see here in this country. Do you have anything else you want to say about whether you feel you had an advantage growing up in a mission field? Or how were some of your other feelings when you first came back to go to school? For Lene, it was hard. She came back and entered a college where she didn't know a soul. She didn't know her aunts and uncles very well. We left and went back to Tanzania, and she had a hard road.
But yeah, that was a real privilege too, because my aunts and uncles, I mean, were so open to me. And I think I have the advantage over the rest of my family is I went and I spent my breaks, my summers. I mean, I live with my aunts and uncles and I know them, you know, and that's I think I know them a lot better now than if I had lived here in the States all my life and just to go and see them, you know, a day or two here. I mean, I really feel like I know my family. So that's, you know, there is a blessing to that too.
I think that goes even with just our immediate family. I mean, we were away from Mom and Dad for 9 months out of the year. The time that we spent together as a family, you know, we really put an effort into that time, and I think as a result, well, that's one of the results why we're very close. And, well, we enjoyed being with each other.
Our easy meals, especially as they were in high school, we often didn't leave the table till 9 o'clock. Because, well, for one thing, we eat late, and we just sit and keep talking, or sometimes we would plan to play games, but we never got around to it because we'd get off on some subjects and we'd keep talking. But there weren't the outside influences out there that our first house. houses until the last one that we lived in were cement houses, built of cement block, much on the ordinary style here, L-shaped living room, dining room, a kitchen with covered bedrooms and a bath. The house we've lived in since 76 is different. It's a mud house with a grass roof of our own choice. It is a, three units. Two units are six-sided with a connecting hallway with a bath and toilet. We have cement floors. We have glass windows, which is different than the native people have.
Plastered walls, paint on?
Yes, we have a thin veneer of plaster on the wall so we can paint it. People are very surprised when they come into our house. Our thatch roof works as air conditioning. You will feel on very hot days a considerable difference in temperature when you come outside and inside. Then we, our bathtub is made out of burnt brick and cement.
Can you pick up just a little bit?
Our bathtub is made out of burnt brick and cement. When the mason was shaping the bottom of the tub, he asked me for a spoon so he could round the corners. Our toilet is very automatic. It is indoor latrine because of the water problems that we often have. So we have that, and it works out quite well. And then we, the other unit that's connected on is three bedrooms. We are on a very steep hillside, so we have a terrace, and up on the next terrace is another six-sided unit, a hut, if you want to call it that. And in that hut is my husband's office and my classroom that I've used for my various teaching projects in the storeroom. We have running water when he can keep water in the tank outside, so it runs inside. Our water is heated with firewood in a boiler-type affair outside.
Do you have wells, or do you catch water from rain in supply tanks, or is it pretty much like a...
Or most places, it would be piped water from a spring someplace. In mountainous areas or where there's hills. Out on the plains, then you depend upon cisterns a lot. Or a well, deep wells. But deep wells are difficult. They're very expensive to dig, and they're very expensive to maintain. So there aren't very many of them. And they also, there are many places in Tanzania, it's difficult to get water except through these very expensive wells. Where we are now, well, yeah, and where we've lived before, we've always had piped water from hills, springs up further up. But this then becomes a real problem too, and not for us only, but for all the people. The village where we live now had a pipeline put in. Well, the colonial government put in this pipeline towards the end before independence. It was in a valley. It was a beautiful stream. It was clean and a very dependable supply of water. There are very few people living up there. But now, since that time, the people have moved in because any bit of land that's available, they use, and they pay no attention to conservation. They dig right down to the edge of the stream and plant. The cattle and goats and sheep are many more than they used to be. And they water all of them in the stream. The people bathe in the stream. So the water is just so polluted, it was terrible. Even at the best of times, if you keep the pipe open from being silted up, you'd boil it. You'd have the good smell of a barnyard. Well, we corrected that somewhat by putting collecting water. Fortunately, there was another little stream across the road where it was forest area, and they're not supposed to be in there. The cattle go in there, but there's no farming in there. So we have much better water, but it wouldn't pass health standards in, well, any place. So we have to boil it, although it's usually quite clean to the eye.
You indicated the population has increased doubled, I guess, in less than 20 years. There's few parts of the world that will sustain an increase in food production of that proportion. Would you make any comment on that race between food production and population expansion?
Well, Tanzania is fortunate in that they're not overpopulated. But the problem with a rapidly expanding population is that you have a very few number of the people having to support a very large percentage of the people because they're non-productive. Now, this happens in different ways in different parts of the world. In Tanzania, you have a few having to produce for many, many of these younger people, 15%. 65% of the population being under productive age yet. In some of the older countries, in some other countries that where this has turned around, you have a small percentage of the people having to produce for a very higher percentage of retired people together with a certain number of young people. But they don't have the industrial base, they don't have the equipment to do it with, so it places a real burden on the country. They are able, though, to produce. There is enough good land, arable land in the country. Distribution is the real problem. And, of course, fuel and tools and equipment are difficult to come by.
As the population is expanding, I mean, we're going to hit a point where there's going to be overpopulated as far as being able to feed themselves. The one problem is as people are moving out from the previously settled areas, they're moving out to start new villages. And these villages lack services. And there are large areas of Tanzania where there isn't water, and people just can't live in these areas. Other areas people cannot live yet because of the tsetse fly.
The tsetse fly, which brings
sleeping sickness, and it attacks man as well as animals. And so until these problems can sort of be conquered, but there are places where you could drill a well how deep and you'd never get water. And people cannot live in these areas without water.
Is there a predominant tribe or clan that rules the country?
No, that's the benefit of having many tribes. It's not like it's been in Nigeria or Kenya or Uganda and some of these others where you have a predominant tribe. This is the blessing of many, many tribes.
Did you have a language barrier at all? Or do they all, is English the common language?
No, it's Swahili.
Swahili.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, you have an evil system having produced a blessing. It was the slave trade that spread the use of Swahili language through the country. Something good comes.
Where the Gold Coast is.
That's on the west coast of Africa.
And I worked with men, social workers from there.
How we doing?
Well, we are at the end of our official time now, and we really appreciate what you have shared with us today. For those that have more questions and would like to stay, feel free to do so. Willing to answer questions. Those of you that have other things that you want to do or need to do, go ahead and go. But I think it's been a real fascinating hour to listen to the Hagbergs and share with us some of their experiences. And I think it's a real blessing that we've had the opportunity to hear them and to hear about people like this dedicating so much of their life and giving up so much of what we all know to work with these people. I think, as we've seen, they have received many rewards for it, far different from what we think of in terms of the tangible things as the TV sets and fancy cars and all of this. So they've probably been blessed in many ways that we don't realize. But it takes dedicated people to go out and live in this type of environment and deal with the problems they do. It's not an easy life by any means.
And we would like to say in return, we thank you for the support that you have given in the past and will continue to give in the future as members of the Lutheran Church.
Two more plugs. First of all, every year there's what they call a global mission event. Some of you have heard about it. Has anybody been to one?
It's a bit more LCA.
It's LCA.
It's LCA, but next year is going to be with ALC and LCA together. It's going to be at Northfield.
Minnesota, St. Olaf College.
It's like an open university, and
it's a four-day seminar thing.
Weekend, yeah.
And they push not only foreign missions, but North American missions, and anything that comes under the heading of missions. Anyone who's ever been to one is very excited about them and keeps going back. This year, the two are held in Michigan and Virginia. They try and have two a year in the summer, and they scatter them in different parts of the United States, but they always have to use college or university for facilities. The one I attended 2 years ago in Fremont, Nebraska, we were over 900. And the one they had on the East Coast was about the same attendance.
What are the dates? Do you know next?
Roanoke, Virginia is 14th. No. 11th through the 14th.
St. Olaf, next summer.
I don't know. It'll be in July.
July.
I would guess it's about the third weekend of July. That's just a guess.
And secondly, then, thanks again for the support. You know, the Lutheran Church, the Board of World Missions, either ALC or LCA, they've been very, very good. They've taken excellent care of us, and they've been able to do that simply because of people like you.
So we've never
worried about having a ticket home. never missed a paycheck.
What about retirement?
We got the same as he will have, or any other pastor.
I'm wondering about how are their feelings in regards to birth control. Like in here in China, there's a real control there now. Now you said a lady is pregnant, what, maybe 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe all her babies don't live.
No, they don't.
A lot of them do, or you wouldn't have received it.
25% of the children born die before the age of five.
Well, this is kind of too bad. How do they feel about birth control?
Many want them, especially the women, but it's not readily available, any method except sterilization, and they're very, very afraid of operations. And it takes them a long time to recover. If you're on a poor diet, as most of them are, it takes them 2 to 3 times longer to recover from an operation than it would with us. And some of them have to go a long ways away. Just for instance, where we are, several of my friends are interested and very badly want. But to go to a hospital that can offer them any hope or any help, I should say, is 100 miles away. All right, that's bus fare. It's getting someone to take care of the children at home, to go there, to find a place to stay, to get whatever help they whatever means they want for help. Then the bus fare back. You can't always get a bus the day you want. You might have to bribe to get a seat on the bus. You know, it seems so enormous that they just don't. It's a big problem. As far as the pill is concerned, it is more readily available now than it was. But they will only give one month supply at a time, and sometimes it doesn't arrive in time. So it's a difficult thing, but more and more are wanting it. The economic costs are extremely high of sending a child to school, of educating them, of clothing them even. Clothes are terribly expensive. And so they see the economic cost is really pressing. And therefore they want to limit their families. And a few are beginning to realize that if we have fewer children, we can take better care of them, and they'll probably grow to adulthood, versus many children, and you hope that some of them will grow up, because your children are your social security and your pension.
Yes.